and everyone on this Friday. We have two items for work session, one for public hearing and possible work session. We're going to go to work session on House Bill 2389, not intend to move it today since some committee members want some time to look over those amendments. So I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2389. Call forward Scott Berry.
Good morning, Chair Close.
You have these amendments before you.
Good morning, Chair Close and members of the committee. The amendments I believe you have in front of you to House Bill 2389 may look like a gut and stuff of the original bill. In reality, it's the exact same content, but the words have been changed to, I think, appease all those involved and make sure we weren't crossing any process with the Construction Contractors Board. We met with the trial attorneys as well. Everyone has signed on to the bill. And the amendments that were sent to legislative council, so we're really ready to go. But having said that, I understand it's a lot of amendments and a lot to go through. I can kind of run through a couple of the sections with you if you'd like to, or we can...
Please do.
Okay. The initial section one just talks about the definitions, and we have added remediation to define repair there, which was not in the original bill. In Section 2 is the initial process requiring an owner to send a notice out to the contractor. So in that Section 2, it kind of defines the notice that goes out from the owner to the contractor. And then Section 3 is the response from the contractor or secondary contractor. And secondary contractor means any subcontractor, supplier, or anyone else who worked on the job site. Those folks will be noticed by the original general contractor who received the notice from the owner. So the original notice comes from the owner to the general contractor. The general then looks for those folks who he thinks may have been involved in that piece of the defect, that part of a possible construction defect, and then sends out those notices. We also have in there one change, and that is we've allowed for a viewing of the possible defect in addition to the inspection. And the idea there was that we sat down with everybody that had an issue and a concern with this bill. We wanted to make sure that the contractor got a chance to go out and initially take a look at the potential problem. And it's literally that. It's a visual examination so that they knew, well, you know, is this a big deal? Do I need to alert the insurance company? Do I need to, go through this whole process? Or is this something that I just need to come out and fix? It's a minor issue. If it is something that they feel would warrant a full inspection, then they contact the subcontractors and coordinate an inspection of the home, which could include testing and things like that. Section 4 deals with the inspection process, and again, in viewing inspection, I just kind of went through that piece of it. Again, we added visual examination. Section 5 would include the offer from the contractor, and then acceptance for rejection on the part of the owner, in part or in all. And we've obviously left an opening there for the owner to accept three of the five solutions that were offered by the builder, or none of them, or all of them, and in the process that occurs at that point. And if they accepted, let's say, three of five, the other two would then be able to move forward for a possible claim and lawsuit, if that was their intent. Section 6 is the tolling, and there is one area where we have basically told the statute of repose. We had initially submitted language to legislative council that said, or any other statute that applies, because our intent is that during this 120-day process, if the owner is running up against the statute of repose, which is 10 years, that statute would toll until this process was finished, so that they wouldn't lose their opportunity to move forward with a claim in court if they so desired. Section 7 describes the notice procedure and says you must go through this before you file a legal claim. Section 8 is a notice to the consumer, which will include in a contract or at some other point during the initial sale, and it talks about this process and that it exists. It tells the consumer that that this process exists and that they need to go through it before filing legal action. It's really a lot like the Construction Contractors Board notices that occur when a remodel is done or a house is sold that say, you know, here, there's a process here. You can file a claim against your contractor, and here's how to do it, and here's what you do. Section 8 is the, again, talking about the owner needing to go through the process before filing, before arbitration or court action. And Section 9 removes all those folks who this does not apply to. That includes landscape contractors who are concerned that this would circumvent their process, which is very similar to the CCB. So we did not have them in the original bill. We've added them so that, again, if you want to go through that landscape contractor process in the first year, just like you would go through the Construction Contractors Board process in the first year, you can, and this doesn't affect that. We sat down extensively for quite some time with Bill Boyd from the Construction Contractors Board, who's their legal advisor, so, and made sure that there were no problems there. And then the architects had a concern and wanted to be removed out of the bill, and that's also done in Section 9, Sub 3. And that's the gist of it.
Questions, Representative Shoffler?
A comment and a question. Thank you. I think for obvious reasons this is going to help protect innocent parties and avoid frivolous lawsuits. But just for the record, this in no way ties the hands of anybody who is seeking damages due to neglect, incompetence, or defective materials, correct?
That's correct. Chair Close, Representative Shoffler, in no way. It simply says, before you go through the process, notice your contractor, let them come in and take a look at the property and take a look at the damage and see if you can't work it out. And if you can't, off you go to court.
Thank you.
Representative Kitts.
Scott, two things. Number one, this is what appears to be, I would define it as a good consumer bill. I mean, obviously it allows someone to talk directly with the contractor, if I'm understanding it correctly, before any legal fees are incurred and the arbitration has to be gone through, so on and so forth. Because basically, if there's a problem that exists, it then is rectified directly and within the 14 days response. Is that correct?
Representative Close and Representative Kitts, that's true. I mean, it's a longer process than 14 days, but within the period...
The first response.
That's correct.
What I'm
that's correct.
To.
And today, currently, often the contractor has no idea what the problem is when they go to court. They simply head off to court with some idea that they've been sued by one of the owners of a house they built previously and don't really have any idea what the problem is or whether they'd be willing to simply go in and repair it and avoid the whole court issue.
It appears that everything that this committee had requested of the work group that got together with this, with the concerns that were addressed last time, have been addressed, and I would eagerly support it. So thank you for doing what was requested.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum. Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm not clear the inspection of the defect versus the inspection that was contemplated in the original bill. How many separate inspections could there be if, say, there was a contractor and a subcontractor?
The idea behind this is the intent is that the visual examination will be the original contractor who receives the initial notice will go out and take a look at the site. And that wasn't in the bill, and we just didn't want that to serve as the inspection, because really they're going to go out and take a look, and they may not need to coordinate an inspection of all the subcontractors or suppliers that might be involved. At that point, once they've taken a look at it, they can decide whether they need to set up the actual inspection, which again could include testing, and coordinate that with the other subcontractors to make sure that they get in, and they in some cases may need to do some work to do that, and then repair that work, which is also in the bill, making sure they bring the place back up to snuff before they leave after the testing. It does allow for some repair, however, if both parties agree in writing that they could do the repair right there once the window is out or whatever the issue might be.
And a follow-up, Chair. As the homeowner, how this is a new process, and it's a fairly complicated one. How will I, as the homeowner, learn what I need to do? At what point do you contemplate that the homeowner becomes aware of all these requirements?
I think there's three ways. The first is that, and I went through it briefly, that back in Section 7, there's the original notice that goes out with any new construction or construction. That notice goes to the consumer. It's a consumer notice just for that purpose, to let them know the process exists. Secondly, we'll be doing some education with the Construction Contractors Board, so that the Construction Contractors Board gets calls, which they often do, on problems that have occurred after the first year, so after their purview, then they would notify them of this process, and we'll have some information that they can send out. And third, I think if the consumer initially goes and contacts their attorney because they intend to go to court, the attorney would then find this process and notify their client. Obviously, we're hoping for the first two, but the third certainly could happen.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, can you give us a sense of the most common types of suits that homeowners file against a builder? Now, we're talking about that period outside of the first year, I understand it.
Well, I think it can cover all sorts of things. Lately, it's been common to find the EIFS claims, which is a fake stucco product that had some serious problems with sealing the framing inside the house and not letting any moisture out. And so that caused some trouble. That was a problem. LP siding, obviously, at one point was a problem. So siding has been a big issue in the past, but it can be anything from roofing to windows to, I don't think there's any, I'm not aware of anything that shows one particular type of problem, other than the one I mentioned.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Follow up.
Is there currently there's a kind of a statute of limitations is it 10 years that you have the ability to sue now for defects in construction?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Representative Merkley.
Okay. In Section 6, which places limits on the time that a owner can file suit, and 120 days after receiving a written response that doesn't contain an offer to perform remediation, 120 days after rejecting a written offer, or 30 days after a date specified in the written offer by which the offering contractor is to complete remediation. I'm a little concerned about these time periods, in that often, at least my impression of the process is a lot of grayness around this. For example, a homeowner says, say, I have these various problems, and maybe the response is, well, we don't think the siding is that serious on the east side, on the west side, maybe it needs to be replaced, maybe on the north side, let's look at how healthy it is 2 years from now. And that condensation inside your windows isn't really my issue as a, you know, and it's suddenly now, how will I as a homeowner know that I have a clock ticking for 4 months, or actually a clock ticking for only 30 days, which for many of us would be very easy to overlook in the hecticness of worrying about normal family affairs?
Well, I think in terms of your first question, the written response from the contractor also includes a written report or other document evidencing the result of the inspection and the existence or non-existence of defects. So they will receive a report from the inspection that took place that outlines and details the concerns that the inspection found. In many cases, they're going to have probably some inspection done themselves to determine whether or not there's a defect to move forward with in the first place, if they're planning legal court action, which is, of course, what starts this process.
So what if the contractor says, yes, I'm going to take care of this within 2 months, the other piece I don't think there's a problem with. Now the homeowner has two different timelines they're operating on if they want to pursue it according to this, because one timeline would be driven by the rejection and one would be driven by the planned remediation date.
Well, I can tell you, Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, that the intent is for the for the repairs to be done, and if they're not done in a proper time manner, or payment is not made in a proper time, timely manner, then the, you know, the court action would then commence. So that's the intent of the bill. It also allows the general contractor to repair anything that a subcontractor said they would repair if they don't follow through with that repair. And our interest there is making sure that if it was something that should have been repaired and a subcontractor or supplier agreed to, it would allow then the general to go in and solve that problem without going forward with a court action.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott, for your work and for the work group's work. We will intend to read over these amendments this weekend and reschedule. We'll have to post for Wednesday. And I would ask the committee to read them over, and we will take more questions at that time.
Thank you very much.
Close the work session on House Bill 2389. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2130. And Megan, refresh our memory on this bill, please.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2130, we heard on Wednesday, deletes the requirement that retired local government employees be charged health insurance premiums according to family status categories. Declares emergency effective on passage. There is a -2 amendment which clarified the language that the local government and health care insurer may not create a group solely for the purpose of rating or establishing a premium for health care insurance coverage of retired employees and dependents that is separate from the group for health care insurance coverage of officers, employees of the local government and their dependents. There's also a fiscal statement attached. And there's no other question for the bill.
And do we have anyone to testify on this work session? Okay. You representing Backlund? We have a quorum. Missing a few people. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2130.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the -2 amendment to House Bill 2130. Is there discussion? Is there anyone opposed? Seeing none, the work. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2130 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum has moved House Bill 2130 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallego?
Aye.
Representative Bernard?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Pitt?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Clerk
Close.
Votes aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 2130 goes to the floor. We will intend to have Representative Backlund carry this bill since it's his bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes.
May I request an opportunity to vote on that bill?
Did we miss you?
Yes.
I voted for
okay.
you.
Oh. You voted twice.
I got to vote twice. I apologize for being out.
Okay. How do we do that? Just make a note to record. Okay. Okay. We will record. Do you want to verbally say, should he verbally say his vote?
No, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
I vote aye. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure. I apologize for being out away from my chair.
The next bill committee is Representative. Okay, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2130. The next bill is Representative Patridge's bill, and he is in committee, so we will need to take a. We will need to stand at ease until we can get Representative Patridge here. Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. We'll come back to order. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2767 and invite Representative Patridge to testify, and the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2767 allows an employer to determine and make reasonable deduction from the employee's wages to remedy loss or damages to employer or a third party because of a theft by the employee in the course of employment. Thank you.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me, members of the committee. I apologize for being late. We had a subcommittee chair meeting for Ways and Means to discuss the package that's being offered. I bring you House Bill 2767 as a result of talking with many employers and crime victims. The thrust of this legislation is predominantly that a lot of theft occurs, and I'll just give you an example from the business that I'm in, which is the long-term care business. We have situations where employees will steal things from residents, from people who are in nursing homes or in assisted living. You have on occasion employees who do that. Consequently, then, the employee gets fired, and then you're required to refund them their whole entire paycheck. And as a result, even through the district attorney process and the court system, there's never any restitution paid, and these people claim and usually can't get a job afterwards because they have a theft conviction, so it's harder for them to get a job. But the crime victim, in this case, never gets paid. But you're required to provide them their employee paycheck, which is payment, which I believe is probably more justified to go to the victim of crime who had that resulting piece being stolen. So consequently, we drafted House Bill 2767, which basically has two changes in the law under Section 1, small number 3. That was a legislative council. That's how they're changing things to read these days. So that was another piece. But on the back page, under item number F, basically it allows a deduction in a reasonable amount determined by employers made to remedy a loss or damages to the employer or a third party of theft by the employee in the course of the employment with employer. So consequently, they can deduct from an employee's paycheck the reasonable amount of what was stolen. The employee is not prevented from making their wage claim as they would normally through the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And if they felt that they were unjustly fired because they were accused of stealing something, they would probably make their claim anyway through BOLI, because an employer would typically deny their unemployment insurance because if they were innocent of this particular piece, they would be making a claim for BOLI anyway, and they would also during that time make the wage claim that their final paycheck was inappropriate. So there is a remedy for the employee that is consistently there, that is directly in line with what currently happens under the law if they think that they were wrongfully terminated for theft or something else. So that's the thrust of the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair. This got quick set, so I'm not quite as prepared as I want to be or brought people here, but if you have questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay, Representative Garrard.
Representative Patrick, can this occur without due process?
Well, the process would be, in this case, if what would happen would be is an employee would be fired. The employer would determine the reasonable amount of what they believed was stolen, and that would be the grounds for their termination 99% of the time, probably, and in some cases maybe that plus other things. They would determine the reasonable amount, and they would be able to withhold that from their paycheck. The employee could then make a claim to the Bureau of Labor and Industries that either the amount was not reasonable that was withheld from the paycheck, or that their termination and subsequent deduction from their paycheck was not a reasonable ground for termination. And they would go through the bully process.
Follow?
And then Representative Shelton.
So your answer is yes?
My answer is yes. Sorry.
That's all right.
I'm a lawyer. I get paid by the word. So.
Please don't charge.
And I'm not going. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on labor, and I don't. And you know what? I don't see due process in this. Maybe it's because I'm not a lawyer. But if you think, with all due respect, specifically this language, sir,
there is no way I can support this. I think it's a slap in the face to workers. It gives the employer the ability to assume guilt and keep withhold earnings of a worker on the assumption that worker stole something. Now that's a lot of power, and that worker may not have the financial ability to sit and wait for some long, Lord knows drawn how long drawn out government process to get their weekly check. It's Representative Petridge, if you put in here that there was some kind of due process, some kind of court, some kind of anything, I might be able to support it, but the way it's written right now, there is no way. With all due respect, sir. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just in response to that, Boley has its own whole set of statutes. The courts have their own set of statutes. There's already due process in the system. It's not necessary to, I mean, if there was something that you wanted to put in here that was that provided more comfort. I mean, the due process exists within the Boley law and how wage claims are done. And, you know, to get the comfort level of the committee, I'm happy to help educate or have people from Boley come talk to you about some of these particular methods and how it would go through. But it would be very, very difficult, and I can't imagine setting up a whole other system by where a wage claim would happen. You know, to me, this is a straight-up public policy decision, whether you want to allow employers to deduct from paychecks to deal with crime victims or theft that occurred against the employer. Lots of employee theft occurs. Lots of people are caught as a result of it, and there are not a lot of, that I'm aware of, there are not a lot of cases that come to Boley where people say, I didn't steal things. And are overturned. So I think the remedy is there.
Madam Chair, may I just follow up?
Follow up.
And don't get the wrong idea. Somebody's a thief. He should be fired. He should have to pay restitution and maybe go to jail. I haven't got any problem with that. So I just wanted you to feel that's how I feel about thieves. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Representative Petridge. If I am an employer and I feel like I have a pretty good knowledge, pretty good evidence that an employee has stolen something, maybe a co-worker has witnessed it or so forth, do I have any civil remedies currently to seek restitution from the person who has stolen the products?
Now, Chair, Representative Merkley, certainly you have civil remedies in order to do that. The problem is, in most of these cases, you can't squeeze blood out of a turnip in a lot of these cases, and it's hard to continue to track these people down. A lot of employers write off these employee theft issues because it costs them too much money to even attempt to pursue the employees that they've had to terminate as a result of theft. And in addition, specifically in the long-term care, skilled nursing, and assisted living facilities, you know, you have these people who steal, you know, $100 out of your grandmother's drawer at the nursing home, or steal their diamond wedding ring or something like that, and then they take off, you fire them. And there's really no recourse. You know, it goes through the criminal justice system, you know, on occasion too, but that's a lengthy process too. This is an ability when money is available to be able to take the money if the employee was wrongfully terminated or the amount was inappropriate. The employee has a reasonably quick method by which they can be repaid their funds.
I'm sure. Can I follow up?
Follow up.
I suspect that in a lot of circumstances there's a level of suspicion among an employer more than a level of proof, if you will. For example, things are disappearing, you're not sure who's doing it, and then maybe you think that, well, there's a pattern here, and I think it's probably this person. And so you fire him, because one way you'll find out is if the thieving quits. Maybe you sent a message or you've got the right person. But, so I'm sitting here as an employee. Maybe that person's getting a paycheck by the month. So I held a month's earnings in my hands. Now, this, in some ways, this is a pretty powerful incentive for me to think, well, you know, they may have been responsible for this string of thefts going back a year. So it's reasonable for me to take their entire monthly paycheck Where's the balance in that kind of process that where there's really not a standard of proof to, it's a suspicion on my part, maybe it's a reasonable suspicion, but it's not a standard of proof.
Madam Chair, Representative Barkley, again, employers don't accuse employees of theft and terminate them for theft. They have to terminate them for valid employment reasons. They would have to say because of employee theft, that's the reason they terminated them. They would, you know, they're subject to, and consequently they would deny their unemployment and other things because it would be a termination for cause. So this isn't something that an employer would come to lightly just on a whim. They don't fire people. I mean, you hear horror stories on occasion, but as someone who practices employment law and has probably over close to 4,000 employees in three states, who I review terminations and all those kinds of things. It's not something that employers deal with lightly. And, you know, I haven't run the bully statistics or anything else. We were going to prep some of those things. But, you know, I'd be happy to come back and educate the committee, Madam Chair, and members, and talk to some other people if that's the committee chair's wish in this case.
Representative Rosenbaum. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Representative Patridge.
Good morning.
The scenario you're describing is somebody who is fired because of this act of theft, but my reading of the bill doesn't limit this ability to deduct to just a termination situation. It seems to be modifying the employer's ability to deduct or withhold from wages under any circumstances. So the scenario could happen that, you know, I was eating, I don't know, peanuts if I was working at the nuts shop and the employer decided that they wanted to start deducting from my pay for what they thought I was eating. And I don't see any remedy in that situation where I'm still working there and they're just taking money from my paycheck. Maybe that wasn't the intention, but it looks to me like it's a deduction that unilaterally the employer decides what the amount of, and all they have to say is that they think I was stealing something.
Well, if you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you look under the section and read the bill, in Section E, this is upon termination. It falls within under the termination of employment. Deductions made from payment of wages upon termination of employment is authorized pursuant to written agreement. And then it goes on, and it provides the conditions, is what I believe. And I've got to go back, and this was a quick set. But the intent of the legislation is if they're terminated as a result of employee theft. If you, I mean, I'd be happy to walk through this more, but.
And I would say, committee, if you look at D, it says at termination of employment and then you go to E, and then it has or, so there's an and then an or that leads into the boldface.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a condition of termination.
Can I
correct Representative Patrick?
Could I just follow up?
Wait, just a second. Am I reading that right?
I'm trying to.
It's the and in D at the end.
And this, now that that's the board, so it's the and.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah.
So this is the E that falls.
Seems to be tied together there.
I think that is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Rosenbaum, and then I think we're going to allow Representative Patrick to go back to his committee hearing.
Well, we can talk about it at greater length, but it might be a drafting error. It just looks to me like the F with the or in front of it sets a new circumstance that applies to the paren 3 on page 1, that an employer may not withhold, deduct, or divert any portion of the employee's wages. And then it lists out a number of circumstances under which you can do that. And all those things that apply to termination are really applying to specific separate circumstances, so it may, maybe it didn't get drafted.
Well, I'll run it by Doug McKean in Legislative Council again to answer that question, and but I'm happy to do that. Is there any, you know, people can talk to me individually, or I'd be happy to talk to the individual members of your committee, Madam Chair, to see where we're at on this.
Well, thank you, Representative Patrick. I think it's a really interesting concept because, as you say, if someone's missing $100, they really can't go to an attorney, and they would use that money up in attorney fees. So I would like to see them have some remedy, and if you could work on this, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close. No, I'm going to go to the next group of witnesses, and I'm going to call up two separate panels in the interest of time, Dan Gardner, Bureau of Labor, and Marcia Olin Miller, Bureau of Labor and Industry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and with me is my legal advisor, Marcia Otten Miller, who administers the administrative law judge process for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. House Bill 2767 today, I have my written testimony before you, but it is up to the Bureau of Labor and Industries to, through the Wage and Hour Division, administer this particular section of law. I guess rather than read my testimony as you can, I'd just simply make a few comments on the bill. Is that this bill, to me, flies kind of in the face of long-standing legislative intent in the fact that the concept people need to get to understand in current law is that the paycheck is not the property of the employer. It is the property of the employee for the hours that they have worked. It's the wages that they've earned. The way this bill currently is written, my understanding is under just about any scenario, an employer would have a separate distinction that's not paralleled anywhere in law in that they could be judge, jury, and execute the remedy all in one fell swoop to the employee. There is no standard within this of proof. We get complaints all the time from employers where they believe they can withhold money from the paycheck of an employee because a uniform is missing and they believe it's, you know, the employee who took the uniform or didn't return the uniform. There's always been a firewall between employer and employee and where these standards lie. The paycheck's the property of the employee and then therefore must be paid to that employee for the hours they worked. By the same token, if the employer fails to pay final wages to the employee cannot go off into the safe, into the petty cash, for instance, and pay themselves. There's always been that firewall. And they can't just go and adjudicate their own remedy either on the employer or the employee side when there's a grievance over wages. I think there are current standards, in my own opinion, under current law where there is remedies for the employer to get monies owed in these types of situations from the employee through the court process. There's also a few terms within the bill that are very concerning. There's no level of proof to theft, and we would have to establish rules for what, you know, theft would be determined, whether it's what form of burden of proof. There is no definition, really, of reasonable amount. Would that also include in, for instance, Representative Patrick's scenario of the $100, could they take them the $100 plus the administrative time of their administrator to go through the process of trying to find out who did what and how it all happened, what other charges could be applied? It really doesn't define any of that. It doesn't even define what a third party is, whether that's a customer, a fellow employee, an insurer. There are dozens of scenarios I could give you of what could happen under the way this bill is currently written. You could have a series of five employees at a Kentucky Fried Chicken, for instance, where suddenly a customer claims that $1,000 is missing from their wallet, and the employers suddenly decide that everybody that was working that night pays their equal share. With no proof, no process, no anything, and that would be inevitably, under state law, legal to do as long as the employee under federal law was paid minimum wage. So basically, in a lot of minimum wage situations, you could not do that. But if it was a higher paid employee, you clearly could. I just think that
let me just ask you. Representative Patridge said that it would be at termination of employment. The person would have to be fired. So in that scenario, that employer would have to fire all those employees.
Under my reading of the bill, Madam Chair, it sets up a dual process. This does not, as I read the bill, set it up at the point of termination. It doesn't have to be at the point of termination. It can be either at a termination or at any point in time that the employer decides that something has been taken.
So that would need to be made clear, is that what you're saying?
Well, there's several things within the bill, Madam Chair. I would personally think it would have to be made clear, yes.
Okay.
And I'll leave it to Marcia.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Commissioner Gardner stated, I'm Marcia Olemiller. I'm the legal policy advisor for the Bureau of Labor and Industries and also supervise the administrative hearings unit. I'd like to draw your attention to the overall purpose of the statute that this bill would amend, ORS 652-610. This statute actually is about accountability by employers to employees for what happens to their paychecks. So as we're all familiar with our own paychecks, we get the check stub and on there it tells everything that came out of there, and hopefully you're familiar with and you understand and it's okay with you that all those things are coming out of your check. Historically, in prior times, employers were allowed to keep pretty much some or all of an employee's wages as they pleased for amounts that they felt were owed to the employer. And I think most of us would agree that times have changed for the better and that there is this accountability under the law now by employers to explain why they're deducting amounts from employee paychecks. We don't want to go back to the days of the company store where the employer can decide, you owe me your entire paycheck, or you owe me a substantial amount of your paycheck, and I don't have to really give you any process for that or any remedy. I'm just going to take it. So I think we have to look at sort of the larger universe that we're operating in here historically and as far as the rights of working people.
Could I ask you, I understand what you're saying, and I think you have a good point. But tell me how an employer, if they are missing, you know, from $100 to $500, as Representative Patridge pointed out, what are their remedies other than small claims court for an employee that they might not even be able to find?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm glad you asked that question. I also wanted to return to that matter because Representative Merkley asked that question earlier, what are the remedies? And the remedies are covered actually in the legislation or actually in the statute that this would amend. If you look under Section 4, where it says nothing in this section shall be construed as prohibiting the withholding amounts authorized in writing, and it talks about charitable contributions to charitable organizations, this statute does try to cover every eventuality where a deduction would be legitimate. Charitable contributions, doesn't prohibit deductions for dues to labor organizations. And it also says, nor shall this section diminish or enlarge the right of any person to assert and enforce a lawful set-off or counterclaim or to attach, take, reach, or apply an employee's compensation on due legal process. So you could take someone to court to small claims court for an amount like that. You could, in fact, if they did sue you and allege some sort of discriminatory termination or something, you could assert a counterclaim if you were in court. You can't do that in our forum, but you could do that in court against them if you felt that they had stolen money. There are civil and criminal avenues as well. The other policy question that comes up is, do you want employers to resort to self-help in a situation where serious theft may have occurred? Is it appropriate for an employer? As I read this bill, it wouldn't even be limited to a small, sort of small-time theft. It could even be bank embezzlement. Do you want the employer to just decide, I'll handle this by just deducting these amounts from the employer's check? Or shouldn't they be going to law enforcement? You might have a pattern and practice of thievery going on here that law enforcement ought to know about. So there are remedies under civil as well as criminal law now, and the statute is well designed to provide that those remedies are not inhibited by the prohibitions on deductions. It is true that those remedies may take some time, and it's true that for some employers that would be frustrating, that they've got this money in hand and they'd like to just take it now. But we are looking at due process. The statute, the bill uses the word theft. That's a crime. So we're talking about accusing and sort of convicting someone, if you will, of a crime, and then imposing a penalty and exacting that penalty, all without benefit of due process. It's been asked, or it's been discussed, whether BOLI's processes would be sufficient. And we run an administrative law hearings forum. We are in no way equipped to try a case of theft beyond a reasonable doubt. We're under the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, so our standard of proof is substantial evidence. And so if, in fact, this were limited only to termination, that doesn't really resolve the problem. You're still talking about due process. You're still talking about whether this is an appropriate way to exact a penalty from someone when you believe that they have stolen money or taken property or otherwise. The other part of the provision about damage to a third party is also concerning, because it's not clear who you're talking about here. As Commissioner Gardner mentioned, is this a customer, a coworker, an insurance company? You know, where would this stop as far as who the employer could extract money for? So those are some of the concerns that it raises for me as an administrative law person in our agency.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you. Marcia, it's good to see you again. It's been a long time. It's been about 8 years since I was an intern back in Washington, D.C., and Marcia worked back in Washington, D.C. as well. And Commissioner Gardner, it's good to see you again as well. My question is this. What is to stop somebody, either currently or if this goes into place? Let's say I have somebody that works for me, and all of a sudden I say, I'm missing $500.
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, to my understanding, nothing would stop you. I mean, principally, my personal feeling on the bill is it turns around the basic premise of law that you're innocent until proven guilty and makes you guilty until you're proven innocent.
That's my concern is maybe somebody's doing a doggone good job at their job, and maybe there's a personality conflict, or maybe... And we all know there's a myriad of different discriminatory reasons that one could use. It would just appear that my instant concern with this, and tell me if I'm accurate with this concern, is that there doesn't seem to have to be any evidence of this action to take place. It seems as though I'm an employer, I'm missing $500, you work for me.
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, as I read the bill, I would agree with you. That is exactly how it reads.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Shoffler.
I'll be brief. You know, business is a risk. You take a risk. Life's a risk. And you hire somebody, and they may or may not be a thief. But, you know, I work for a lot of people myself in my real life. And if I put a new driveway in for somebody, I take a risk. I assume they're going to pay me. Usually I ask for something up front just to cover the cost. Now, if they don't pay me my final payment, which can happen, it's a risk, it's a chance you take. If I follow the exact same logic in this, if I could go and if they didn't pay me, and just remove their car from that driveway and say, that's payment. And you know what? You know, we all know where I'm going to end up if I do that. And that's exact same logic as this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Dan, I had one more question. Suppose this bill were rewritten to say that the check is held if there's a legal, and maybe this goes on already, can you tell me, if there's a legal action pending, can a check be withheld until a legal action is resolved?
Madam Chair, no. Again, the final wages of an employee is the property of that employee, and any other, no matter what is pending in the courts, that's a determination by the courts, and they can certainly garnish future wages, but a final check for an employee must be paid in the timely fashion prescribed within law. By the same token, if there is pending legal action, Madam Chair, that is, you know, to an individual employee, the money they may be paying rent with, which they don't have a, you know, if in Representative Patridge's scenario that you already challenged their unemployment claim as well, they may have zero money coming in if that were an innocent charge. Having pending legal action, you could be withholding the very money that person needs to exist.
Representative Gerard.
Good morning, Dan. What if the employer-employee sign an agreement as a condition of employment to this effect?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, I have always personally hesitated on having them sign a written agreement prior to employment, because certainly and one who, particularly in this economy, is looking for work will sign darn near to anything in order to get employment and get a paycheck. So there is a bit of heavy-handedness, if you will, in whatever an employer could ask an employee to sign. You know, again, unless there were change to current state law, I don't believe that would be upheld.
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, if I may respond to that as well. If you look at sub 3 of ORS 652.610, which is the statute being amended, it says an employer may not withhold, deduct, or divert any portion of an employee's wages unless, and then it spells out the specific circumstances under which it's currently legal in Oregon to withhold or deduct wages. Sub C of that section says if the employee has voluntarily signed an authorization for a deduction for an item, provided that the ultimate recipient of the money withheld is not the employer and that such deduction is recorded in the employer's books. This does provide for an employee to approve a deduction under certain circumstances as long as it falls under here. Another consideration that we have to remember, too, is that federal law does not allow deductions that would take the average wage below the federal minimum wage. And so Oregon would be subject to that no matter what our state law said.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks. This is Representative Kitts.
I wanted to follow up to my chair's question as far as withholding. If you were to currently, and you know this better than I do, obviously, if you were to currently, it is against the law currently, is it not, to withhold someone's wages if it's not something that's already been, you know, preset, like child support or something of that nature, as the chair had suggested, to possibly pending legal action. It is currently against the law to withhold an employee's paycheck, is it not, other than for those pre-assessed reasons? You can't be post or potentially assessed reason. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, that is basically correct. As Marcia just read from the statute, it's only under those particular conditions that it currently can be. Again, it's I think it's the concept that the paycheck is the property of the employee, that for wages, hours they've worked, money they have earned.
I just want to make sure I understood correctly. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may just make one final comment. There seems to be some confusion between, first of all, about whether this is only in termination, would only apply in termination circumstances, but also what an employer's recourse is if you have an employee that you believe to be a thief. You can discipline that employee right up to termination. You can terminate them for that reason. There's nothing prohibiting you from doing that. Termination is a penalty in and of itself. And if that employee does then come after you legally for that, then you have the potential of counterclaim against them for the theft that you believe occurred. So you are not, as an employer, without any recourse if you have an employee in this circumstance.
Okay. One more question.
One last question, Representative Kitts, and we're going on.
And I apologize. I feel like I'm starting to sound like some other members of this body. But I don't want to do that. My question...
Go ahead.
Yes. And I don't want to open Pandora's box.
Time's up.
How does this relate with when we're talking about deductions, voluntary deductions, signed deductions, pre-assessed deductions, or terms of employment, like my good friend Representative Girard pointed out? How does or how do union dues fall into that very category as far as having to have a deduction for union dues that are not voluntary, they're mandatory upon condition of employment, and can be withheld? I don't see that as specified. How does, and I don't want to, God knows, I don't want to open Pandora's box on paycheck rejection.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, you know, my understanding of the law in that particular area is that it would fall under those things that are mutually agreed upon between the employer and the employee. And union dues is not something that's mandatory or non-voluntary. No one forces anyone to take a job that, you know, that in fact, you know, may require that employee to join a union. They can, I mean, I'm certainly in prior life was a union electrician. I didn't have to work for a union contractor. I could certainly go work for a non-union one as well.
Sure. Thank you. And I will not ask any more questions for this duration of this committee hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call the next panel, Tricia Smith. Today. David Nebo, I believe, Oregon Law Center. Patrick Green, Oregon, Amphibale CIO. And Madam Chair, while they're being seated, could I just clarify one thing, too? In answer to what Representative Kitts just raised, there is a provision in parentheses D for the deduction being authorized by a collective bargaining agreement to which the employer is a party. And payroll deduction of union dues is not something that happens automatically. It has to be negotiated between the union and the employer. So there are a lot of circumstances, like I think retail, trade, grocery industry, where there isn't payroll deduction of union dues. But I think that would cover the situation where they have negotiated that as part of with the union contract.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. I want to welcome our panel and committee. If, in the interest of time, if we could not go back to areas we've already covered, if we have new material, that would be great. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public sector union of 20,000 classified school employees and certified school employees in Oregon's K-12 community college and ESDs. And I'm here to oppose House Bill 2767. I appreciate Representative Patridge's concern for the frustration that some employers must feel when they feel that they don't have an ability to recompense losses due to theft. Having been a victim of burglaries multiple, I feel the same way. Whenever you are a victim of theft, you feel as though something should be done to compensate you for that loss. Unfortunately, in my burglaries, that has never been the case. And I would suggest to you that this bill establishes a new class of victims, that being employers who have the ability to reach into the pocket of an individual that they believe has stolen from them and take back what they believe is owed to them. We have processes, as you've heard from previous speakers, that I personally think are adequate to all of our needs, because we have to balance our ability to regain our losses with our need to be protected by due process. The only other point I will make to you is that I think for my members who all work under collective bargaining agreements, if this bill were to pass, what it would do is create a new item of bargaining for us. We would have to spend our time at the table talking with our employers about how to deal with due process since the law took it away. And so we would hope that rather than trying to fix this bill, you instead look to those who can assure you that our processes are as good probably as we can get in balance.
Tricia, I'd like to follow up on your burglary situation. And I guess the question that's in my mind is, you know, is there due process? Did you go through the courts with your burglaries? Were you able to recover anything?
No, ma'am.
Madam Chair, may I comment, please?
If my neighbor, I love my neighbors, by the way, but I'll use it for it. If my neighbor steals my TV, and I know it's my television, and I see him through his own picture window watching my television, under the law, I may not go into that house and take that TV back. If I do, I will be thrown in jail. So even if you have evidence, which this doesn't even line out that there is evidence available, it's on the assumption that someone stole from you, you can take it. Well, that now, you talk about a Pandora's box. It's going to be a huge box without getting into the union dues, which I won't. But I just had to comment on your analogy. Thank you.
You can tell it's Friday. Okay. Let's go on to David.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Niebel. I work for the Oregon Law Center, which is a private nonprofit providing legal services to low-income people throughout the state. In the context of this bill, our representation usually involves low-income farm workers. We represent low-income farm workers in a variety of situations, often on wage claims. And I don't want to belabor what's already been said, but I think this bill presents some real problems for farm workers in terms of pursuing remedies when they think that there has been a deduction wrongfully made for theft under if this bill passed and a deduction were wrongfully made. Because farm workers are more likely than not to be migratory. And it's very hard for a farm worker to follow up on a claim as Madam Chair posited, if there was an employer felt that they were missing $100, what would be their remedy? It's unlikely that they would go to a lawyer to pursue a claim for $100. It's even less likely that a farm worker who was here today and perhaps in Goldendale, Washington, tomorrow, if they thought they were wrongfully deprived of $100 based on a theft, to be able to pursue a $100 claim, even with through the Bureau of Labor. So it's very difficult. It would be very difficult for those particular kinds of workers to pursue claims in this under these circumstances. I'd also just point out that wages are entitled to specific protections in Oregon law. Large D on line 2 of page 2, it sets out a limitation on the termination on the deduction that can be made on termination, even if the employee agrees. You have to leave the employee a certain amount, which is the amount that's protected from garnishment, and that amount that's protected from garnishment is protected even after someone has been sued and there has been due process. This would allow, under the way that the bill is constructed now, this would allow an employer to make a deduction beyond even that level of protection. So I think this bill needs a lot of work before it would be acceptable to low-income workers, and I would urge you to reject it. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to Patrick.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Green. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'll do my best not to to tread over too much on ground we've already covered. So I'll make a couple quick points. One, I think you can't. Right now, we have a presumption that employees are good and honest, and are going to do their work and get paid, and that they're innocent until proven guilty in terms of theft. And I think that Boley did a good job of saying how this bill would change this. I also think that, you know, one of the things that Representative Patrick said was that good employers don't just fire people, but bad ones do. Bad ones do just fire people, and if, unless there's a union contract in place, there is no due process because most employees are at-will employees. And so unless there's some sort of racial or ethnic or gender, those sorts of protections, other than that, people can just fire people, and sometimes they do. The other thing is Representative Kitts had asked if I'm missing $500 in this room, what should I do? And I think one of the things that we've had is that I think that he should call the cops for the reasons said. And actually, in an employment situation, oftentimes calling the cops sends a message. When employees are let out in handcuffs, sends a message around theft, whether or not it's happened or not. But I would say that one of the things that happens in this bill, because of the third party part, is it affects the burden for both employers and employees. For employees, the burden is for them to prove that they earned this paycheck and didn't steal, and they have to go through BOLI in order to do it. And so that's not good. And then there's also a burden on the employer because of the third party claim. Because then instead of going to the police, or instead of going, if a third party or customer or something like that has money stolen from them, they would then see the employer as the person who can get them what's theirs. And we represent about 180,000 workers in the state of Oregon, including long-term care workers. And in a long-term care setting, you do have people who have dementia, who have Alzheimer's, who don't know where they are. They're missing their diamond wedding ring, and they put it, it's in a different drawer than it was before. Some of these things can be taken care of. Some of these things can be taken care of quickly, but we don't know if Mrs. Jones gave her wedding ring for safekeeping to her granddaughter. There's cases, particularly in the long-term care setting that Representative Patrick talked about, where it can get very dicey to make assumptions and then start deducting from people's paychecks. So I just have the working conditions, keep that in mind. So with that, on my testimony. Thanks.
I just had one question for you, Patrick. I'm concerned, and I've seen this happen, where large employers, retailers especially, if there's a huge amount of theft, they'll get to the point, and I've seen it done in Portland, where they just close shop and move out of an area because they can't recover these losses. They keep writing them off, and so they just go someplace else, and then everybody loses their job. And, I don't know what the remedy is to that. It seems like, there's a level at which we may get to that we could actually lose jobs. Because of the fairness issue of what do you do about theft? Do you have any ideas about that?
Well, I think that it's, I don't know what you do in terms of, I think theft is, I wouldn't condone theft, and I agree with Representative Schaffler, just there's no, we cannot tolerate people stealing on the job or in any other circumstance. I do think that theft is an issue, theft can be an issue, but there's lots of reasons why employers would move, and maybe it's theft because of shoplifting. I think we're seeing a lot more cameras going up and that sort of thing on employees and on their customers. So, I think it's a law enforcement issue, and we need to take care of it in those terms.
Okay.
So.
And Representative Gerard, and then Merkley.
Okay. Pat, I don't know whether you want to answer this or someone else, but. Under Section 1, subparagraph D, it says the amount of the deduction at termination of employment does not exceed the amount permitted to be garnished. And perhaps this is a better question for our BOLI representative, but I was hoping maybe you knew offhand. What is the maximum garnishment?
Well, I would say I don't know that, and if the BOLI people are here, I'd invite them to come up, and I'm not sure about the revised statute. Do you know, David?
I do. Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, it's $170 take-home income per week is exempt from garnishment. Up to a quarter of your wages. So if you have $1,000 take home a week, they can take $250. If you have $200 take home a week, they can take $30. So it's the excess over $170 up to a quarter of your disposable income.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Representative Merkley, and then Gallegos.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler, I was confused by your earlier statement. Could you clarify for me again how you feel about this bill?
Happy to.
Representative Well, that way it goes. Moving right on.
Point of personal privilege.
Patrick, I appreciate that you mentioned that you represent long-term care facilities. I think the one thing that stood out for me was, you know, the third-party folks, and especially, of course, the ones that target your heart being the seniors. We have a growing, huge number of seniors in Oregon, and those, you know, become the most vulnerable. And maybe this isn't the right vehicle for it, but the means of being able to protect our seniors, who, which there is increasing amount of theft going on in our long-term care facilities, not particularly who, you know, you can't. Do you have ideas about or thoughts about something with a much more narrow focus that would help protect and provide some restitution, which for a day like today, where seniors have nothing to fall back on, you know, the wedding ring was gone, they've hawked everything. I mean, that's what I'm thinking of, and there's no restitution. But if you have some thoughts on a more narrow...
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I think that it is a concern, and we do have a growing aging population, and one of a big group of workers we represent are in-home care workers who help the elderly and disabled, and most of them are angels, and they do the work for very little pay. And one of the things that we worked on doing was to establish a home care commission to increase standards, training, for these sorts of workers. And when you increase standards, you're going to get a better quality employee. I mean, one of the things that's hard is that long-term care facilities, and for a number of reasons, long-term care facilities and care for the elderly, just like care for children, the pay is low. It's very low. And so you don't attract the sort of high-quality worker that you'd want to take care of your mom and dad all the time, right? Because, or keep them, right? Because it's not something that's sustainable. So, I mean, I would argue that in order to, in order to take care of this, it would be to improve the training, improve the wages, improve the conditions and requirements for people who work in these sorts of facilities.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
But getting more specific, though, there are always exceptions, and people do, on occasion, will make that terrible mistake and steal, and specifically restitution for those seniors where it can be through the court system. You know, some mechanism, by that time, there is no money left for that senior to go to and be compensated for their loss. I mean, I want to be a little bit more narrow than train everybody, but when there are cases, do you have...
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I would say that, I mean, it's still a concern. There does need to be restitution. I would just say that the employer-employee relationship is not where that would necessarily need to be taken care of, but should be something more for the courts to deal with.
Madam Chair, any comment?
No. One last comment, and we are going to move on.
Thank you. I have to have liability and bond as a contractor. Maybe there could be some kind of bonding of these employees just for these specific kind of circumstances.
That'd be an interesting idea. Just think on that. And it's just really, my thought is that very narrow situation of the long-term care of vulnerable seniors.
Well, thank you, everyone. I think it's been fascinating discussing this, and I appreciate your coming and your comments.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing. Can we deduct that from your wage?
Mine.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2767, which has generated a very fascinating discussion, I think. Thank you, everyone. And I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that LC 1774, 1776, 2615, 1963, and 3154 be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Kitts has moved LC 1774, 1776, 2615, 1963, 3154 to be introduced as committee bills. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, motion carries. And is there anything else for the good of the committee? Well, thank you, everyone, and I hope you all have a good weekend. We are adjourned.